Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 337, The Protocols of the Elders of Oil, Part 2. This is being recorded on November 25th of the year 2001, and we're going to continue with a discussion that we engaged in on Side 1 of this program, and this concerns some very interesting political connections between the Saudi Arabian power elite, and in particular Crown Prince Abdullah, who, as we saw, was sort of the member of the Saudi royal family who meets with the favor of Osama bin Laden. And we're going to look at connections between Crown Prince Abdullah, members of the Bush family. We're going to look at communications that have taken place between them. And we're also going to be reviewing information from previous broadcasts by way of setting not only that information from previous broadcasts in the present context, but also in order to help flesh out depth concerning some of the terrible events that have been surrounding September 11th. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article that we looked at in For the Record Program number 331. This is an article from the Financial Times of London of Wednesday, October 10th of 2001. This article is by Rula Khalaf, K-H-A-L-A-F, in Riyadh. It's headlined, Saudis Warned Bush Over Policy on Israel. Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia told Washington 10 days before the September 11th terror attacks that U.S. policy towards the Arab-Israeli conflict had become untenable. According to diplomatic sources in Riyadh, the prince's letter to President George W. Bush prompted U.S. reassurances that apparently led to U.S. backing for the establishment of a Palestinian state. The Riyadh sources said the letter was part of a dialogue started in the June meeting in Paris between Crown Prince Abdullah and Colin Powell, U.S. Secretary of State. The letter shows the world's largest oil exporter trying to influence U.S. policy on the Middle East conflict at a time when Arab public opinion and governments had become increasingly disillusioned by U.S. backing for Israel. This suggests that President Bush's statement last week supporting the idea of a Palestinian state was not directly tied to U.S. efforts to bring Arab nations into the coalition against terrorism. The Saudi message is believed to have indicated that U.S. bias towards Israel was making it impossible for the Saudi leadership to follow policies that were in both countries' interests. President Bush is said to have written back to reassure the Crown Prince that the message had found a listening ear. Note here that Crown Prince Abdullah, viewed with favor by Osama bin Laden among the Saudi royal family, was in touch with George Bush and had written George Bush 10 days before the September 11th terror attacks that U.S. policy towards the Arab-Israeli conflict, at least as manifested to date, had become untenable. Bear in mind that a few days later, the Saudi intelligence chief, who had been Osama bin Laden's mentor, resigned, and that hours before the Saudis and U.S. were to engage in joint military maneuvers, the Saudis canceled those maneuvers without explanation. Now, more about dialogue between George's Bush and Crown Prince Abdullah, but this particular element of dialogue takes place between Crown Prince Abdullah and the elder George Bush speaking on behalf of his son. Now, bear in mind that that Crown Prince Abdullah is again the member of the Saudi royal family viewed with greatest favor by Osama bin Laden. We looked at this article in For the Record program number 310. This program is from Sunday, July 15th of the year 2001. This broadcast, by the way, this was also looked at in For the Record program. Excuse me, it was in For the Record program 308 that we looked at this element. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Sunday, July 15th of 2001. This article is by Jane Perlez of the New York Times, P-E-R-L-E-Z. It's headlined, Bush's Father Contacts Saudis on Son's Behalf. For the second time in the past few months, former President George W. Actually, this is a mistake. It says former President George W. Bush. Perhaps this is an example of wishful thinking. It should be. For the second time in the past few months, former President George Bush has intervened in a critical foreign policy area, calling Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia to reassure him that President Bush's, quote, heart is in the right place, unquote, when it comes to the Middle East, a senior administration official and a diplomat from the region both said. The former president telephoned the Crown Prince, who has complained that the current Bush administration is too close to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, before Secretary of State Colin Powell was dispatched to the Middle East by the White House in late June. The point of the call was to vouch for his son and to assuage concerns for the Crown Prince, the day-to-day ruler of Saudi Arabia, that some strains in the United States' relations with Saudi Arabia over the Israeli-Palestinian conflict do not represent a permanent breach, they said. Now, note, in these first few articles, first of all, the 10 days before the attacks, Crown Prince Abdullah, viewed with favor, apparently, by Osama bin Laden, criticized the George W. Bush administration and said that its stance vis-a-vis the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was unacceptable. Bear in mind that in midsummer, the elder George Bush, contacting Crown Prince Abdullah on behalf of his son, said, don't worry, in effect, that his son will, quote, do the right thing, unquote. Now, bear in mind, Crown Prince Abdullah, the elder George Bush, and the younger George Bush, we're going to take a look at a business entity that connects Crown Prince Abdullah and the Saudi royal family with both Georges Bush and the elder George Bush's Secretary of State, or former Secretary of State, James A. Baker III, and the bin Laden family, as we saw in For the Record program number 329, and as we reviewed in For the Record program number 334. That company is the Carlyle Group, and we're going to review a piece of information that was contained in For the Record program number 284. The following is from the New York Times of Monday, March 5th of 2001. This is an article by Leslie Wayne, W-A-Y-N-E, of the New York Times. It's headlined, Elder Bush in Big GOP Cast Toiling for Top Equity Firm, and it reads in part as follows. During the presidential campaign last year, former President George Bush took time off from his son's race to call on Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia at a luxurious desert compound outside Riyadh to talk about American-Saudi business affairs. Now, this is, again, through under the auspices of the Carlyle Group. Speaking not only of Bush, but also of another employee of Carlyle, James A. Baker, again, the Secretary of State under the elder George Bush, skipping down, traveling with the fanfare of dignitaries, Mr. Bush and Mr. Baker were using their extensive government contracts to further their business interests as representatives of the Carlyle Group, a $12 billion private equity firm based in Washington that has parlayed a roster of former top-level government officials, largely from the Bush and Reagan administrations, into a money-making machine. And, skipping down, of the Carlyle Group, we read, and bear in mind, in addition to the elder George Bush and James Baker, another person with connections to Carlyle is George W. Bush. And we're going to take a look at George W. Bush's position on the board of directors of an interesting Carlyle Group subsidiary, bear in mind, and we're going to review this information in a minute, bear in mind that the Carlyle Group had participation by the bin Laden family. Bear in mind that on October 25th, they pulled out of Carlyle Group because of public relations reasons. That is to say, the bin Laden family did. Skipping down, Carlyle also gave the Bush family a hand in 1990 by putting George W. Bush, who was then struggling to find a career, on the board of a Carlyle subsidiary, CaterAir, an airline catering company. So George W. Bush on the board of directors of a Carlyle subsidiary, CaterAir, which is an airline catering company. For those of you who are going to be engaging in holiday travel, just contemplate the possibility of flying on an airplane that is being served by CaterAir, a subsidiary of a company capitalized in part by the bin Laden family, and bear in mind that George W. Bush sits on the board of directors. More Bush administration, George W. Bush appointees who have been active through Carlyle. For instance, Frank C. Carlucci, he was a Secretary of Defense. For instance, Frank C. Carlucci, a Reagan Secretary of Defense who, as much as anyone, is responsible for Carlyle's success, said he met in February with his old college classmate Donald H. Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, and Vice President Dick Cheney, himself a defense secretary under former President Bush, to talk about military matters at a time when Carlyle has several billion-dollar defense projects under consideration. So Rumsfeld and Carlucci discussing with Carlyle some of the potential defense acquisitions being contemplated by the Carlyle Group. And we're going to review a piece of an article that we looked at in For the Record program number 329. The following is from the Wall Street Journal of September 27th of 2001. This is an article by Daniel Golden, James Bandler, and Marcus Walker. It's headlined, Bin Laden Family is Tied to U.S. Group, and it reads in part as follows. If the U.S. boosts defense spending in its quest to stop Osama bin Laden's alleged terrorist activities, there may be one unexpected beneficiary, Mr. bin Laden's family. Among its far-flung business interests, the well-heeled Saudi Arabian clan, which says it is estranged from Osama, is an investor in a fund established by Carlyle Group, a well-connected Washington merchant bank specializing in buyouts of defense and aerospace companies. Through this investment and its ties to Saudi royalty, the bin Laden family has become acquainted with some of the biggest names in the Republican Party. In recent years, former President Bush, ex-Secretary of State James Baker, and ex-Secretary of Defense Frank Carlucci have made the pilgrimage to the bin Laden family's headquarters in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Mr. Bush makes speeches on behalf of Carlyle Group and is senior advisor to its Asian Partners Fund, while Mr. Baker is its senior counselor. So again, reviewing the bin Laden family connections through Carlyle Group to, among others, James Baker, Frank Carlucci, the elder George Bush, and as we've seen, the younger George Bush sits on the board of directors of a Carlyle subsidiary, Caterair, which is in the airline catering business. And that is truly an interesting concatenation to contemplate. What we're going to do for much of the rest of the program is to review some aspects not only of the Saudi-American petroleum politics that have taken place clandestinely, we're also going to take a look at how that relates to some of the people that we've been looking at in this discussion about the protocols of the Elders of Oil. Of course, the title is a slight corruption of the title of the anti-Semitic tract, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, that was one of the linchpins of Adolf Hitler's anti-Semitism. And I would note that there is a great deal of sort of clandestine and to a certain extent chic, or at least sub rosa between the lines, and to a certain extent at this point at least chic anti-Semitism. We're hearing all about Israel and what they did or did not do. And as I said in For the Record program number 334, not only was this attack in the works for several years, even at a time when Israel and the Palestinian factions were at least appearing to come to an accord, but Israel has no oil. And for 25 points in the game, just consider the following. When you last filled up your tank, did you fill it with A, matzo ball soup, or B, gasoline? This is not hard to figure out. Bear in mind again now, returning to the substance of the discussion, bear in mind the connections between the Carlyle Group and Crown Prince Abdullah, the member of the Saudi royal family viewed with favor by Osama bin Laden. Bear in mind the dialogue that took place between Crown Prince Abdullah and the elder George Bush and the younger George Bush administration. This dialogue has involved at various times. First of all, during the campaign of 2000, the elder George Bush was in contact with Crown Prince Abdullah through Carlyle, talking about Saudi-American business relations. Bear in mind that during the summer of 2000, the elder George Bush, speaking on behalf of his son, was contacting Crown Prince Abdullah, saying, "Don't worry, the younger George is going to do things about do the right thing with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian question." And bear in mind that 10 days before the attacks, Crown Prince Abdullah warned W that his stance on the Israeli-Palestinian question was unacceptable. Bear in mind also that after the attacks, the members of the bin Laden family that were in the United States, and they were apparently based in Boston, where both planes took off that crashed into the World Trade Center, from which both planes that took off and crashed into the World Trade Center departed, bear in mind that they were flown out of the U.S. by the Saudi government. We're going to take a look once again at some things that we looked at vis-a-vis the 2000 campaign. First of all, bear in mind that during the 2000 campaign, the price of petroleum, which had been quite low, began to go up with rising prices at the gas pump. This placed pressure on the Democrats and Al Gore because the price of gasoline was going up, leading to economic problems, as it always does. Basically, everything uses oil. When the price of oil goes up, then everything goes up, and people's spending power and institutions, plural spending power, goes down. In addition to the fact that the elder George Bush and Crown Prince Abdullah were in contact during that summer in connection with Saudi American business affairs, a very interesting thing happened vis-a-vis Israeli-Palestinian relations, and we're going to begin with that discussion by reviewing a couple of elements that we looked at in For the Record program number 334. First of all, some of the people who were involved as negotiators on the part of the PLO vis-a-vis the Oslo Peace Accords were people who were, in point of fact, not only protégés of James Baker, the elder George Bush's Secretary of State and a key operative on behalf of Carlyle Group, but they were also coached in the latest public relations techniques by the Central Intelligence Agency. We're going to turn once again to a remarkable but unfortunately titled book called The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People. This was co-authored by former Justice Department investigator and career military officer John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. It was published in hard and soft cover by the St. Martin's Press and copyright 1994. In addition to some 120 or so pages of footnotes for a less than 500-page text, this book drew on hundreds of former U.S., British, and Soviet intelligence operatives for whom John Loftus had power of attorney and who, under condition of anonymity, got permission from the CIA to publish their accounts of bygone history. And of a group of Palestinian negotiators, including someone who has been very, very visible in the so-called progressive sector, as I call it, and someone who's been very visible in the wake of the September 11th attacks, a woman named Hanan Ashrawi, the negotiators, so-called moderate Palestinians, or at least official Palestinian negotiators, for the PLO in their peace negotiations with Israel were not only protégés of James Baker, but were also coached in PR techniques by the CIA. Turning to the secret war against the Jews, the CIA secretly brought several moderate Palestinians to the United States for intensive briefing. This group, codenamed Baker's Dozen, unquote, included most of the, quote, official, unquote, Palestinian negotiating team with Israel. Quote, Hanan Ashrawi, Ashrawi, Hana Senora, Saeb Erekat, Sari Nusebey, and other lower-ranking Palestinians were summoned to Langley for a three-day conference on integrating their politics with the U.S. Ashrawi was singled out as a good Palestinian image spokeswoman, dubbed by the company the Palestinian Golda Meir, unquote. Now, this is significant, I believe, for several reasons. I would note that, again, Crown Prince Abdullah, viewed with favor by Osama bin Laden, was in touch with the elder George Bush in the summer of 2000 about Saudi Arabian business affairs, and bear in mind that the bin Laden family has capital participation in the Carlyle Group. In the summer of 2000, President Bill Clinton was attempting to broker a peace process between the Israelis and Palestinians, and on the same day that Dick Cheney, not only an oil man, but also the Secretary of Defense under the first George Bush, was named vice presidential candidate, Yasser Arafat, despite being granted 95% of the occupied territories and a Palestinian state to be officially recognized by the United States, walked out of the Camp David Accords. New York Times, Wednesday, July 26th of 2000, had the two following lead stories. The lead story is by Jane Perlis, headlined, Clinton Ends Deadlocked Peace Talks. And the on the other side of the page, by Frank Bruni, B-R-U-N-I, Bush names Cheney, citing, quote, integrity, unquote, and experience, unquote. And that concerns the naming of Dick Cheney as Bush's running mate. Now, what I wonder about is this. First of all, I wonder about the rising oil prices during the summer of 2000. I wonder about the contacts between the elder George Bush and Crown Prince Abdullah through the Carlyle Group. And I also wonder about the connections between James Baker and the Carlyle of Carlyle Group affiliation, and, quote, Baker's Dozen, unquote, some of the moderate Palestinians who constituted the PLO negotiating team. And I wonder, and this is an interrogatory note about the interference, possible interference, I should say, between the Republicans and interference by the Republicans in the negotiating process, because had Bill Clinton successfully brokered a negotiated peace between Arafat and the Israelis, and Arafat was going to get 95% of the occupied territories and an officially recognized Palestinian state, that would have been a major foreign policy coup for the sitting administration. It reminds me of the interference by the Nixon campaign in the 1968 peace negotiations between the Johnson administration and the North Vietnamese. That is a matter of public record, and it helped to doom the candidacy of Hubert Humphrey. I wonder whether a similar interference in a peace process took place in the summer of 2000. We also know that in 1980... there was collaboration between the petroleum industry, between the Saudis, and apparently between George Bush, who'd been director of the CIA, in order to engineer a deliberate petroleum shortage, which helped to create inflation, and in combination with the Iranian hostage crisis, doomed Jimmy Carter's candidacy in 1980 and gave Ronald Reagan the presidency. We've discussed this in, among other broadcasts, For the Record 214 and number 248, and we're going to touch on it again, turning once again to the secret war against the Jews. Talking about a report from the CIA to President Carter that basically predicted a Saudi oil shortage and a Soviet oil shortage leading to a proposed Soviet invasion of the Middle East. In effect, the CIA was telling President Carter that the Soviet Union would face a domestic oil shortage in 1985, causing the worst energy crisis in American history. When the Soviets ran out of domestic oil supplies, they probably would look to the traditional oil suppliers of the United States, especially Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, skipping down. According to several of our sources, the scheme to manufacture—actually, let me begin a paragraph up— members of the intelligence community say that it was not the underlying data that were bad as much as the analysis that was skewed back at headquarters. Quote, "You have to understand who was screwing the Jews," one old spy told us. "The whole phony scheme, the oil shortages, the predictions about Soviet troops in the Middle East, the Saudi arms buildup, all of that crap started coming out of the agency back in 76. The CIA told their boss what he wanted to hear, and in those days, the head of the CIA was an oil man," unquote. Perhaps the truth was somewhere in between. The CIA field agents slanted the data a bit to suit the oil industry, and the analysts exaggerated a bit more. According to several of our sources, the scheme to manufacture phony CIA estimates and push them on Carter began the last days of Gerald Ford's term. They claim that a cabal within the CIA realized that Carter would be the new president, produced the first phony report, and then promptly gave it to Carter as soon as he won, knowing how it would affect his view of the energy crisis. It should be recalled that George Bush was the director of the CIA at the time the oil scam was put in place in 1976. There is some evidence to suggest that it was Bush himself who passed the fake oil estimates to Carter. And it's also alleged here, some of the former intelligence officers we spoke to are adamant that the CIA was not to blame. They claim that CIA contacts in the oil industry cooked the books on the Soviet shortage by feeding misleading data to the CIA. Quote, "The agency had grown fat and lazy in the Middle East," explained one of our sources, again quoting, "The oil companies were a big retirement area for ex-CIA staff. There were so many ex-CIA working for the oil companies that it was easy to fake the data." And, skipping down, "The oil companies and the Saudi government both had access to similar advice from old CIA hands. It almost seemed that Aramco had more of its ex-employees inside the CIA than the CIA had agents in the Middle East. In public, the Saudis dismissed the report as ridiculous and obviously untrue," unquote. In private, they went along with the CIA's declining production fraud. After some reflection, the House of Saud realized that there was an opportunity to sell less oil but make more money. In public, the Saudis continued to insist that they had plenty of oil. In practice, they helped to create an oil shortage. the CIA had created a self-fulfilling prophecy. The Saudis' reserves mysteriously fell by millions of barrels a day, and their pumping efficiency was said to be atrocious and sure to get worse. In a very short time, American consumers would find themselves running out of gas, skipping down. Our sources in the intelligence community state bluntly that someone in the CIA was manipulating the truth for political ends, but not to bolster the president. The idea was to undermine Carter and destroy his support for Israel. In fact, our sources say that the whole oil scare campaign was designed to justify supporting a pro-Arab peace initiative and then to make the Saudis the new superpower in the Middle East. And again, note that George Bush, the elder, who had been appointed CIA director by Gerald Ford, according to this report, may very well have submitted the report that was certainly generated under his watch at CIA to President Carter. And by way of reviewing an element that we've looked at in the past concerning the protocols of the Elders of Oil, bear in mind that Gerald Ford was appointed vice president by Richard Nixon, who then succeeded, or Ford then succeeded Nixon as president, appointed Bush to be CIA director. And we're going to take a look at the genesis of Richard Nixon's political career. Bear in mind that Alan Dulles helped to negotiate the relationship between the House of Saud and the Nazis, and also with the Aramco Company, the Arabian American Oil Company. And bear in mind, too, that Mohammed bin Laden, Osama's father, was very close to King Ibn Saud, the founder of the Mahdi's modern Saudi state. And Alan Dulles was also a financial advisor to the Bush family. Turning once again to the secret war against the Jews, Dulles did not care about OSS ratings for his reports. He cared about protecting his clients and himself. This is Bush family advisor Alan Dulles. Consider the case of Carl Blessing, former Reichsbank officer and then head of the Nazi oil cartel, Continental Oil AG. Conti was in partnership with Dulles' principal Nazi client, I.G. Farben. Both companies had despicable records regarding their treatment of Jews during the Holocaust. After the war, Dulles not only lost Blessing's Nazi Party records, but he helped peddle a false biography in the ever-gullible New York Times. Our sources in the intelligence community say that in one respect, author Chris Simpson missed a major point. Alan Dulles personally vouched for Blessing as an anti-Nazi in order to protect continued control of German oil interests in the Middle East. Blessing's Conti was the Nazi link to Ibn Saud and Aramco. If Blessing went down, he could have taken a lot of people with him, including Alan Dulles and Ibn Saud. The cover-up worked, except that U.S. Naval Intelligence scrutinized a set of the captured Conti reports. According to several of our sources among the old spies, Richard Nixon's political career began in 1945 when he was the Navy officer temporarily assigned to review these captured Nazi documents. Alan Dulles allegedly told him to keep quiet about what he had seen, and in return, arranged to finance the young man's first congressional campaign against Jerry Voorhees. So according to the allegations contained here, it was the politics of oil, the politics of the Elders of Oil, including Alan Dulles, Nazi Carl Blessing, King Ibn Saud, and a young Richard Nixon that led to Nixon's genesis. And of course, using biblical terms, Nixon begat Ford, Ford begat Bush, etc., etc. Annotated descriptions of the various For the Record programs on the subject of 9/11 are available in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire is one word, SPITFIRELIST.com. Programs, meaning CDs and tapes of these broadcasts and other programs, can be ordered from Spitfire at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005, email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is compiling the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming in the archive section of the WFMU website at WFMU.org. Look for Dave Emery. And older programs are available for download only, including the vast bulk of the For the Record programs. There is a link to that longer URL in both the WFMU website and the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, you can access that link. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 337, The Politics of the Elders of Oil, Part 2, being recorded on November 25th of 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.